You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Karen Grigsby Bates, in for Steve Chiatakis. Parading down Pico Boulevard near Crenshaw, the community has turned out with colorful outfits, baskets of flowers, huge puppets, and musicians. The crowd has gathered here on a recent Saturday afternoon to represent Oaxaca, Mexico. It's an annual parade that's known as the Convite, and it takes place right here in the heart of LA's Oaxacan business community.
The productos oaxaqueños, ¿verdad? Hay pues ferreterías, salones de belleza, escuelas de música,
hardware stores, beauty salons, music schools, restaurants, the list of Oaxacan businesses goes on. This celebration happens every year, but this summer it carried a new meaning. Last year, LA City Council members were caught on tape making racist remarks about Oaxacans. Now, a group that has long wanted to designate this area as the Oaxacan Corridor is pushing hard for that recognition. Street signs, murals, art. The community is hungry to claim this space. KCRW's Andrea Bautista picks up the story from here.
There are a ton of enclaves in LA that have been named after ethnic communities. Think about historic Filipino Town, Chinatown, and El Salvador Corridor. But as it turns out, getting that designation is not easy.
En el 2014 fue la primera vez que propusimos, hicimos todas las encuestas, la primera aplicación que sometimos a la ciudad de Los Ángeles.
Mauro Hernández Mayoral is the president of the LA-based regional organization of Oaxaca. He says he's been working on getting this stretch of Pico designated the Oaxacan Corridor since 2014.
Y luego, pues, no prosperó, pero básicamente porque la pandemia empezó.
And then he says the group's original application was interrupted by the pandemic.
Y ahora estamos reiniciando hacer los trámites.
They started the process again earlier this year after the leak of that racist conversation between city council members Nuri Martinez, Kevin De Leon, and Gil Cedillo. In the audio, former city council president Nuri Martinez demeaned Oaxacans for their height and went as far as calling them ugly. Hernandez of the Regional Organization of Oaxaca envisions Pico Boulevard decorated with murals and Oaxacan designs on street posts. He says so far business owners along the street mostly support the idea. That includes Eloisa Maldonado. She has owned Carniceria La Oaxaqueña on Pico and 4th Street for more than 20 years. The outside of her store has a huge mural depicting an Aztec god painted in shades of yellows and blue.
Toda la gente de otros lugares, no nada más de Los Ángeles, sino fuera de Los Ángeles.
Maldonado says the project would help all the people in and outside of LA quickly locate any Oaxacan businesses. For Oaxacan Angelinos at the Convite, the idea of a Oaxacan corridor is exciting. Brenda Mata attends the event with her family anytime she can. Both of her parents are from Oaxaca's Sierra Norte region. She says she loves the idea of recognizing her family's indigenous origins right here on Pico.
It's a nod that says, we know you're here, we acknowledge you, and we respect you, and we thank you for the contributions you've made. Who doesn't want that? I mean, I think it's important. It's important.
But not everyone is sure it's such a great idea. Oaxacan Angelino Fernando Isai says he's not against the representation it would bring, but...
What is going to happen with this corridor? Like, it, you know, it's for tourism, it's for gentrification. Like it's happening in Oaxaca, like it's happening here. You know, it's the people that are being forced to move, live farther and farther away, you know, commute 2 or 3 hours for una miseria. But representation, you know, only goes so far. Without agency, without actual, you know, there's only so much you can do.
Mauro Hernandez says the project has support from LA City Council members who represent this area, Heather Hutt and Eunices Hernandez. But despite multiple interview requests, the council members would not comment on the proposal for KCRW. It'll probably be a while before the corridor becomes a reality, however, because any street name change requires getting signatures from more than half of the property owners along the street. And the Regional Organization of Oaxaca is still working on that. Once that's done, it will eventually make its way to LA City Council for public comments. Angel Martinez lives in an apartment near the proposed corridor with his family. He says he's seen how the street has become more and more of a Oaxacan business center over the years.
To see the entire strip go from nothing to every other block having like a walk-in tiendita. It's really nice to see that development, and it makes me proud to be like, hey, yeah, I'm from Oaxaca. Like, those are my paisanos down the street. They went from having a little hole-in-the-wall store to having an entire restaurant.
And honoring that with the Corridor Project would show how Oaxacans have shaped the city.
I think it would be really nice to have it all manifest into one interpretation of Oaxacan culture.
As the community continues to work through the red tape to make the corridor happen, Oaxacans will continue celebrating their traditions and culture, with or without the city's recognition. For KCRW, I'm Andrea Bautista.
Coming up, using sex to sell t-shirts and other stuff. It was a big success until it wasn't. That's yours on the other side of this.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
More now with Greater LA here on KCRW. I'm Karen Grigsby-Bates. If you lived in Los Angeles in the early aughts, American Apparel and its billboards were impossible to avoid. The imagery was just this side of pornography. Young women in makeup-free, sultry repose, wearing tube socks and short shorts reminiscent of the 1970s. And the tagline, American Apparel is an industrial revolution, promised a sweatshop-free, ethical utopia in its downtown factory. But the promise of revolution wasn't to be, as scandal after scandal plagued the company. A new book, Striptease, that's T-E-E-S, a memoir of millennial Los Angeles, takes a look at American Apparel's problematic beginnings. Its author, Kate Flannery, is here to talk about it with us. Kate, welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So, Kate, you came to L.A. in 2004, having left what sounded like a pretty sad copywriting job at Urban Outfitters on the East Coast. Can you talk about what you were hoping to find out here?
Oh, absolutely. I graduated from college in 2004, and I was a very idealistic young grad, and I landed this job as Urban Outfitters' first copywriter. And I was very proud of myself to have sort of gotten into my preferred field right after college. And I have always been interested in fashion. But once I arrived there, sort of the dismal corporate nature of work really sort of got me down. And I kept thinking, my God, like 50 more years of this, is this really all that lies ahead? And at the time, California was really having a moment, specifically Los Angeles. You know, reality television was booming, the surreal life, the hills, the simple life, you know, Paris's hometown. And a lot of my friends were sort of gingerly making the move over to Los Angeles. Really interested me. I was looking for something new, something totally different. And I landed in Los Angeles, and very shortly thereafter, I was scouted for American Apparel.
Hmm. Your entry into the American Apparel world is an interesting one. You were spotted at a dive bar in Echo Park and recruited on the spot, but it wasn't unique. Can you talk about that, the kind of formula that was used to recruit young women to the fold?
Sure. I was recruited at Little Joy, which is this is real, well, back in the day, a very sort of grimy bar on Sunset Boulevard. It was a dark night. It had all the fixings of sort of something exciting that was going to happen. A woman came up to me and handed me a card, and everything on that card just seemed like the total polar opposite of what had been going on at Urban Outfitters. Urban Outfitters primarily used sweatshops. It was a very stodgy environment. Here's this card saying, come work for our company. We make everything in downtown Los Angeles, sweatshop free. We're doing things differently here. We're a provocative company. That was everything I wanted to be as an idealistic young grad, ready to rebel. And of course, when someone hands you a golden ticket like that, you really feel like you've won the lottery to be scouted. The funny thing is, I would go on to be a scout. And in city after city, I handed out those cards. And really, I never had anyone turn me down. Everyone I scouted came to work at American Apparel because it just seemed like it was too good a deal to pass up.
Mm. And if it seemed like it was too good a deal to pass up, nobody wondered about that? It's like, is this too good to be true?
No, the company was just too cool. Everyone wanted a piece.
Mm-hmm. This all happens under the cult of personality of American Apparel's founder and CEO, Dove Charney. Why do you think this man had so much power over people? What was the attraction?
Well, he had the tool of charisma, which is so important in leadership. He also was a young man, you know, he was only about 10 years older than I was at the time. And coming from an environment like urban, like here I was, I knew the CEO. He listened to what I had to say. He, you know, seemingly respected my smarts and my ability and wanted to, you know, reward people who worked hard. He also was a rule breaker, and it feels good to break the rules. He really brought us all together in a way where we really just wanted to help him fulfill his mission, which is something that we all believed in too. That's really what it comes down to, the mission of the company. You know, that's undeniable, making everything sweatshop free, fair wages. You know, it's hard to look over that and say, oh, well, he was sleeping with his employees. It was very easy to overlook that at the time. But American Apparel and the time it was in, It was just the perfect storm for a company with such heavily sexualized ads and their company ethos to sort of sink its hooks into me while simultaneously convincing me that it was liberating me. So, you know, the patriarchy is insidious. And I just didn't see it, even though it was all around me.
When do you think the tide started to turn for the company? There's this now infamous Jane magazine article that mentions that Charney engaged in lots of self-gratification in front of a journalist. But that didn't seem to faze you. It didn't creep you out. What finally did?
Well, when you read the article, he doesn't just do it once. He does it a few times.
Yeah.
And he asks the journalist, is this all right with you? And the journalist is like, yeah, sure, no problem. And even at the end of the article, the journalist, Claudine Coe, says, you know, I kind of want to stay. Like, I don't want my time to end. Like, even she got hoodwinked, you know? That's how strong he was. And at the time, I know it sounds, when you're looking back, it sounds so crazy, but I really thought that to be honest like that, the relationships he was having with his employees were consensual. And I thought, you know, I was a grown woman at 23, and so were the women around me, and we were, you know, sexually autonomous beings. And if we wanted to sleep with the boss, then that's fine. And if he wants to masturbate in front of a journalist consensually, well, isn't it better that he's not hiding? Isn't it better that he's honest about it? You know, with Dove, you know what you're going to get. So it was really easy to miss those red flags and kind of think that they were marks of, like, progressiveness.
Kate, I wonder what lessons you take from this time in Los Angeles and this time in your life, especially after Me Too and his perspective on power dynamics. I mean, as you were talking about Dove, I was thinking, that's kind of what Harvey Weinstein did, and look where he is.
There's a big difference between Weinstein and Dove. I hate to find myself defending Dove. But, you know, a lot of the women in striptease that he had relationships with are still with him to this day, still live with him, still are engaged with him in relationships. Whereas Weinstein, I think, was more of like a violent predator. But those systems exist everywhere. You know, I left American Apparel and started working at CBS, right, you know, under Les Moonves. So
another Me Too problem.
Exactly. These systems are everywhere. And it doesn't matter. You know, I thought, oh, well, I'll go into television. Like, that's a respectable field.
That's
nobody's going to try to get me there. You know, but these exist everywhere. These awful, like, the patriarchy is all around us. Like I was saying, the patriarchy is insidious. And there's no way to win against a house that's, you know, rigged.
So what's the answer if there's no way to win, if there's no way to escape this?
I don't know. You know, people sometimes think that I have all the answers or that I'm some, like, I've come away from this with some greater knowledge, but I still fall into these traps all the time. You know, sexism is sneaky and it's everywhere. But what I have discovered is, you know, you're always right to listen to your hunch. There's no sense in keeping a secret. If something feels weird, like, talk about it with your friends. That's so important. There was just a lot of secret keeping back then, a lot of assumptions being made. You know, if we had all just talked to each other, we probably could have figured out this stuff a little bit earlier. Maybe we would have been smarter about our decisions.
Kate Flannery, her new book, Striptease, A Memoir of Millennial Los Angeles, is out right now. Kate, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thanks so much, Karen.
Straight ahead, Barnstall Art Park reopens with its first show for local artists since the pandemic. That's coming up after this short break. Moving on now with Greater LA. Barnstall Art Park over in Los Feliz, or Los Feliz if you prefer, is a lovely place to spend a summer afternoon enjoying a picnic and a view, and as its name suggests, you can usually find some pretty great art there too. The Los Angeles Municipal Art Gallery, located in a shady grove at the heart of the park, is one of the city's longest-running art spaces, and each year they offer grants to a handful of promising mid-career artists from across LA. Right now, you can catch some work by some of those artists in a new exhibition at the gallery. Our art insider, Lindsay Preston Zappas, is editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles, and she's here to tell us more about the show. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi.
So before we get into the art, tell us a little bit about the history of these COLA grants. The Municipal Art Gallery has been giving them out for quite a while, right?
Definitely. And like you said, you know, the LA Municipal Art Gallery is really a longstanding arts institution. It was founded in 1954, and it's unique because it's a city-funded art space. It's actually run through the Department of Cultural Affairs. And they've always had this really long history of showing specifically LA-based artists. And so I think that really comes through in this grant program as well. So for this grant in particular, you have to be an LA resident to qualify. And then the grant is somewhat unique in that you actually have to be a mid-career artist to apply. So they require that you've been exhibiting for at least 15 years. You know, so that's a pretty substantial history of making art, showing your work, you're involved in the art community at that point. And the grantees are each given an unrestricted $10,000 and also invited to participate in an exhibition. The visual artists show at the LA Municipal Art Gallery, and then there's also performing artists that will show at the Grand Performances space.
So 10 different artists got the grants this year, right? Tell us about the lineup.
Six of the artists are the visual artists. So these are the ones that you'll see at the LA Municipal Art Gallery show. And for me, every year, this COLA show at the gallery is so exciting because, you know, for me, I always see some familiar names, but there's always discovery and artists that I'm not familiar with who have been living here, working here for years, right? And each artist is really given a substantial amount of space. The galleries are quite large, and so it almost feels like you're looking at six separate solo shows, but there are definitely through lines across the work as well.
So there wasn't a theme that the artist had to subscribe to, but you did say there were through lines, and I'm wondering if you noticed any trends emerging in the work.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, shows like this that don't have a specific theme, and when these trends emerge, it really just points to kind of a certain zeitgeist or theme across LA art making right now, which is really interesting. One thing that I really found across the artists is this sort of interdisciplinary approach to making. You know, most of the artists in the show use more than one medium in the work. So for instance, the artist Kyungmi Shin uses photography, and then she'll paint on top of those photographs to create these really interesting layered pieces that speak to heritage and family. And then Dwayne Paul, who's one of the artists that I was unfamiliar with prior to the show and a really kind of delightful discovery for me, he also starts with photography, making these really moody and dynamic self-portraits. And then he'll pair that with these soft sculptures that he kind of layers and attaches to these photographic frames. So you end with these kind of hybrid sculptural pieces that kind of explode off the wall and into space. So that kind of experimental and mixed media approach seemed to really come through across all the artists on view.
Were there some standout pieces for you, things that just popped?
Yeah. One piece that really stood out to me was an installation by the artist Elise Pignolet, and it was called No Gods, No Masters. And the piece almost looks like a large public fountain or, you know, some kind of centerpiece in a town square or something like that. And as you're walking up to it, you see these hand-painted tiles and ceramic sculptures kind of in that classical blue and white motif. But when you get closer, you realize that each tile is painted with imagery that references either women's rights movements, women's sexual health, or contraceptive and abortion care. So the piece is really subversive in that way. It kind of has this classical motif, but then when you come in, it has this really powerful feminist message to it. It was pretty phenomenal.
Sounds like it. Now, as you've said, all of these artists live or work in Los Angeles. Did you see any pieces or bodies of work that really felt connected to this city?
Yeah, I think that's such a great question, and actually one that the curator asked each artist and provided that in a gallery guide in the gallery. So it was really interesting to read the responses to these questions from the artist. A lot of them spoke to the diversity of our Angeleno community and how having a diverse audience for their work has been really impactful and kind of how the work has been received over the years. Some of them also talked about, you know, the long history of LA artists here who have come before them and really influenced their work. And then one artist in particular, Michael Massenburg, he spoke about seeing the Watts Towers and learning about the Watts Rebellion as being really impactful. You know, his paintings in the Cola Show aren't specific to LA. They picture different communities in the African diaspora, and he kind of collapses them into these fictional collages. But then he pairs his paintings with these audio narratives of people telling their stories. So it's really interesting that he's kind of highlighting narrative and storytelling from an individual perspective and then to trace that back to this influence of LA political uprising.
And there are some upcoming events with these artists, right, Lindsay? Are there any you're looking forward to?
Yeah, it's pretty great. They actually give each artist an opportunity to talk about their work to the public. So some have already passed, but there are some upcoming talks with some of the artists I mentioned, like Elise Pignolet, also Patricia Fernandez, and Wakana Kimura, who is going to be speaking about her work as well. And you can go ahead and register for those at the LA Municipal Art Gallery website.
Lindsay Preston Zappas is founder and editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. Lindsay, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
That's it for us today. Tomorrow, a new study links the Southern California Ice Age to humans, fires, and climate. Sound familiar? Should we be worried? You can visit us online at kcrw.com/GLA or on the iPhone or Android app. You can give us some feedback, tell us about a story you think we should cover, or just tell us how you're doing. And while you're there, grab the podcast to have with you on the go. You can get the podcast anywhere you find them. Just search KCRW Greater LA. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthew, Phil Richards, Greg Warner, Sonia Geis, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordal all make this show happen. I'm Karen Grigsby Bates. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.